Well, you'll win. So I kept, the shadows came, and still we didn't score no run. I was still pitching, no runs yet. No run. I said, Joe, it's about time you get a run.
Uh-huh.
You
know? A true gentleman.
Oh, yeah.
The late Joe Collins, nice guy.
Yeah, nice song.
Uh-huh. He passed away, I guess, a few, not couple, too many, yeah, a couple, two, years,
couple
ago,
years ago. Yeah,
and
uh-huh.
I remember when he, your pitching selection, did you have, now that you told me and explained for the record how you were able to pick up other mm-hmm. pitchers' routines and by their physical movement or mm-hmm. what have you, was anybody able to pick up, did you have a particular pitching selection or routine that you think might have been able to be picked up by other players if they'd been astute enough?
I think in the beginning, until I developed the no windup, then there was a possibility that they could have gotten some of my signs, because I had the same thing. I had the problem, you know, of winding up and when the ball is sticking in your hands, mm-hmm. and that's how they'd, mm-hmm. they'd call the signs.
Mm-hmm.
It's a possibility. Like some guys used to say they would call you signs, because then you had the problem, too, is that when the opposition were telling you that, they were doing that to confuse you, too.
Mm-hmm.
To get you to worry about something.
Yeah, get your mind distracted.
Distracted and all that. So I didn't pay much attention to that. Well, after I started no windup, I don't think anybody got my signs after mm-hmm. that. Because no windup, even the no windup, I could still call signs with the guys in the no windup. But that's a whole, I could talk the rest of the afternoon about all those things.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't stop it, but it stops the majority of calling
mm-hmm.
the signs.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a good spitball?
On the sidelines, yeah, I could throw a good spitball, but
mm-hmm.
I couldn't control it.
Control.
I couldn't throw it in the game. And everybody mm-hmm. says, well, he's throwing a spitball. Well, spitball is the most difficult pitch to control.
It is.
And that's the thing. And so, all that stuff I hear,
uh-huh.
like it's so much deeper. But obviously, I know guys who did throw the spitball.
I heard that Whitey Ford,
and
they finally put a rule against it, that when he'd go up on the pitcher's mound and he'd get, and then he would lean over, let's say, tight shoe
uh-huh.
or something with the ball in his uh-huh. hand and scrape it against the toe of his foot or against the rubber, make a little nick and get dirt in it.
Yeah. Well, what he did, it wasn't that.
Oh.
Of course, if you hear that, he would take, Elston Howard would load up a seam, and they knew what seam Howard was going to load up. Howard would catch the ball like this,
uh-huh.
and he would load up a seam,
uh-huh.
and load a seam. They'd throw back to Whitey, and Whitey knew what seam, they'd turn the ball in his hand. And then Whitey would go back and with the ball, grab the rosin bag and push the ball in the ground, and that seam would become a mud seam then.
Uh-huh.
And then he would pick up the ball, and then he would throw it. So they eventually made Whitey, he could not have the ball in his hand when he picked up the rosin bag. And he couldn't do
could,
that.
Couldn't
but
do
that's
that.
What he would do.
Is that what he would
yeah,
do?
Yeah, mud ball was the most effective pitch you think, because the seam is overloaded
good.
Now.
Yeah, that's right.
It's heavy.
Yeah, on that one, down that
would
go. Well.
And once it hit his glove, then there's no record of it.
That's right.
You couldn't see it.
Couldn't see
it. Nowhere
yeah.
on the ball.
Look at it forever
hand.
And a day.
Yeah, now I knew that. And when I left the ball club, he wouldn't throw it against clubs I was with, because I knew exactly what he was doing.
Yes, I'm sure you could. We could talk
mm-hmm.
about it. We've been going for about almost 2 hours. Would you like to stop at this point?
No, no, that's fine.
Okay.
Go right ahead.
Okay. I just... I'd like to, if I could mention a few names of players and what you remember about them. I've done a little work myself about them. And,
mm-hmm.
Of course, we know the Mantles, the Marises, the Rizzutos, the Fords.
Mm-hmm.
So much has been written, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember, I guess, one of my favorite players, because he was so fiercely determined, and your old neighborhood guy, Hank Bauer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I've read stories that he didn't have that much talent, but let me tell you, when he went out there, he was possessed.
Mm-hmm.
And... Of course, he had that 17-game hitting streak in the World Series. It may
mm-hmm.
still well stand for all I know.
Okay.
You played with him,
mm-hmm.
and of course, then he was traded in the late 50s to the
right.
Kansas City Athletics,
mm-hmm. for Roger
and for Roger Maris. That's right. Some thoughts about Hank Bauer.
Hank was a tough ball player. He was a Marine, as
mm-hmm.
you know, and he was a tough ball player. If I had to have somebody on base to steal a base or make sure a double play is not performing. He was a guy, I mean, he was tough. I mean, he'd run in there, he'd do anything to beat you. And Hank could, surprisingly, he was a pretty good bunter. He was fast. He could run good.
Mm-hmm.
Good outfielder.
He had a good arm.
Yeah, a good arm. I think he hit 20 home runs as a leadoff hitter guy with the ball club.
Mm-hmm.
So he get a base on balls. And he would just tough all the time. That was his way. I mean, that was the whole thing. He was into the game. Now, mm-hmm. after the game, he's Hank Bachman. Mm-hmm. And have fun, let's enjoy himself more than probably any guy on the ball club. But when he's playing that ball game, he was serious. And he was the type of guy that would come down the bench and nudge some guys and say, hey, let's get serious, you know, and pop them, you know.
Yeah.
Not hurt them, but get them excited about doing something. Kind of rookies kind of feared him a little bit because he was quite serious on the bench, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a heart big as anything. Mm-hmm. But he was a winning ball player. And I'm not talking about average now. He just wanted to win. Yeah. He'd do anything to win a ball game. Give you an example of what I'm talking about. Casey, a lot of people don't know this, but they were playing Philadelphia and they're going for the pennant, and I wasn't on the ball club then. But Casey said that anybody that gets hit by a pitch ball and helps us to win that ball game, I'll buy you a suit. And they were in Philadelphia, I think it was the ninth inning, and bases loaded, and Hank was the plate, and the guy threw a ball, pitch inside, and Hank took it. And of course, they scored a run to win it.
Yeah.
But there were quite a few guys in the ball club that do that. Yeah, I was just watching the World Series up in Atlanta, because I have season tickets up there. I've had them ever since Atlanta's been there. And I don't go too often. I use them business-wise. So I went up and watched a game, and I remember watching Olsen, the catcher. And I couldn't believe my eyes. Here's bases loaded. They're playing Philadelphia towards the end of the year, and they got this left-hand pitcher throwing. He throws a ball about this far in, and this guy flies all out of the way. I said, I don't understand this. All you had to do is stand at the ball, hits it, the ball game's over, you win.
Yeah.
Why is he doing all of this stuff? He did it two times in a row.
Scared.
But he ain't going to die. No, ball hits you, he'll die.
Right.
But you win the ball game. Bases are loaded. Let the ball hit you. And then there was another guy, too, Lonnie Smith was the other one who did the same thing. And I was sitting there with my wife. I said, that would never happen in my days with the New York. The manager would have fined you $1,000 if you did that. Because if the guy's going to pitch inside, let it hit you. The game's over. We win. What difference does it make? And see, but that's, they don't, it's not thought about today.
Some of the basics are forgotten.
The basic fundamentals. And the game itself, you know, more home runs, more records. Yeah. I understand all that. But the little fundamentals of the winning the baseball, I think the ball players today enjoy the game, but not as much as we enjoy it.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit different. Yeah. They got more ability, I think, than the guys have because they're in better shape.
Moose Gallen.
Oh, yeah. He was my roommate with the Yankees.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, Bill and I were great friends. Bill is, today, is still a kid.
Uh-huh.
Yes, today is still a kid.
Yeah.
And he's serious, but still a kid. You know, he's one of those guys that, naive. I guess that's the best word to call him, about naive. And he's always got a nice feeling about life and doesn't think anything's wrong, you know. But just a super guy. I mean, I remember calling a pitch one day. I miscalled a pitch. I think I called a fastball, and Sonny Dixon threw a curveball. Moose hit a home run. And when he came in, he said, thanks for calling a pitch. I said, Moose, I called a fastball. but he would swing at everything.
Yeah.
And he was such a good person.
Yeah.
You know? And he's fun to be around. Mm-hmm. People love to be around Moose. Mm-hmm. He's always laughing, having fun. You know? And tries to get a little serious from time to time.
Yeah, but I was thinking about that, I think in 1959, that, playing the Washington, the old Washington Senators, and the game went 14 innings, and the Yankees won 1-0. I think he hit the home run, longest game in American League history, that ended up with only a score of 1-0.
Wasn't that Whitey Ford's game? Wasn't that 16? Was it 16 innings, or was it 14?
It may be 14 or 15.
Yeah,
I'm not sure now.
Yeah.
But I think he hit the home run that ended the game.
Moose had hit a ball anywhere. I mean, he'd hit it in center field. I've seen him hit balls in center field seats and 457 feet away. They'll throw a pitch and he'll look so horrible, it's unbelievable. And then they'll throw the same pitch again and he'll hit it nine miles. You know, he was just swinging at the ball all the time. That's all he was.
Going back to you. The year of winning the Cy Young Award, I'm sure I would assume that was your greatest year that you felt anyway in terms of everything came together in that year, 1958.
Right. 58.
And that's when you came back and beat the Milwaukee Braves mm-hmm. after they had won the preceding year.
Right.
And you came in, pitched some fantastic games. You won the Cy Young Award. What would you say about it that hasn't been written from your perspective and your year, that particular year, that you would like to have known for the record that perhaps has not been written?
Well, I think of every ball player, a Mickey, a Whitey, or any of them, there's one special year that you have mm-hmm. where just everything just blended together. Yeah. And in 58 was that type of a year with me. My control was good. I had perfected a slider and sinker that year. And pitching was real fun for me because I now got out of the feeling I had to strike everybody out all the time. And I used to throw a pitch and have a specific idea where they'd hit it at, and I'd get a double play and things like that. So pitching was a lot of fun for me because it was a new style of my life that came about. And so that. And the other thing, too, is that, you know, I tell a lot of people, being honest, is that I was lucky to have a great year when everybody else had lousy years. You know, I think I was the only 20-game winner in the American League at that time. And, of course, the Cy Young was picked from two, American and National
League. That's right.
And Warren Spahn and Lou Burdett, I think they won 20 games over there.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I had a much better year than they had.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had only lost 7 games. I think Warren might have lost 12 or 13 or 14 games, something like that. But and then, of course, when you pick on a Cy Young, that's already voted on before the World Series starts.
That's
it has
right.
nothing to do with the
World Series.
So. I was lucky to have a good year when everybody had a bad year. That's the way I look at it. But then, as I told you, that was one specific year when everything came together. I mean, everything came together. I started off the year with a rush. I think 9-0 or something like that. And I didn't pitch a lot towards the end of the year because I pitched a lot all year, and then Casey decided to give me a rest because I probably should have won 25 or 26 ball games. But when you look at the record, you probably see maybe I won one or maybe two games in the whole month of September because we were so far out in front of everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then you want to pitch. I mean, that'd make a better salary raise.
Yeah, I wanted to pitch, but
Casey
didn't
said
different
he didn't
things.
Do
he did different things.
Did
you
different.
Know, and in the beginning of the year, I was the one winning a lot, and some guys got some sore arms, so I got to pitch a lot. And then towards the end of the year, you want to kind of rest me a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And then we start off that World Series in 58 first game. I never could get into the groove. And mentally, I always say to myself, I said, well, it was because he didn't pitch much in September, but that's a bunch of BS. You know, that's just the way people try to count. I do it myself.
Because that World Series, you were down 3-1.
3-1, and we came back into New York, and of course, I pitched the game and beat him in that game. I think it shut him out, if I remember. 3-1 or whatever it was. I can't remember what the game, 57. I beat him one game in 57. I beat him that game. And then we got on the plane, and of course everybody had their bags packed because they all thought the game's over, everybody was going home if they beat us. And they didn't win beat us, so now it's 3-2. So everybody has to pack up their bags, and we head up to Milwaukee, Browns Lake, where we were staying. So we got there, and so we go out, I can't remember who started the game, but I relieved Ron Duren. I think he was a winning pitcher. I relieved Ron Duren in the 10th inning or 9th inning, 9th or 10th inning. And I don't remember who hit the ball. I think Del Crandall, but he hit the ball off of my glove to McDougal, stepped on second base, and the game was over. So I finished that. And your style, with their style, when they counted out, that would have been safe. And then the next day, very next day, I'm in the bullpen, and Don Larson starts. First inning, he gets by. Second inning, he gets in trouble. Next thing I know, I'm warming up in the second inning. And I've just pitched 9 innings the next day, and I'm coming back the next day. So they warmed me up, and I came across the mound. And I remember walking by Mickey. He says, if you do it this game, you're entitled to the car. You know, I remember he saying that. So I walked in, and I pitched that whole thing. I think it was like 9 or 10 guys out that game. And then we went on to win the ball game. And a lot of people don't realize that the very next day I pitched in Hawaii. Lou Burdett, myself, and Eddie Matthews went over to play with the Hawaiian team, and St. Louis Cardinals were already in Hawaii, and we played an exhibition game there against them. So they flew us over after games, we flew to Hawaii. Next day we played in Hawaii, and we got beat in Hilo 1-0. And Boober did, and I pitched the whole day off all games to St. Scott. They beat us 1-0 out there. And we had just had Hawaiian, it wasn't even pro team, it was an amateur team.
Seems
we played against the St. Louis Cardinals. But No, it's that was quite a series, and I remember a lot of things. You'll remember if you remember. Because I remember after we won the game in New York, we're going out there with Browns Lake, and then we win the next game. I remember driving in the bus. Mm-hmm. We were about 40 miles out of town, and Mickey got up and he says, you know, he got on the bus, and he's always come up with something real quick. Mm-hmm. He said, I'll be damned. He says, y'all walk around like you're ready to piss in your pants. He said, if we're going to the ballpark, let's just go out and win the game and get it over with, you know. So, kind of shook the club
made him get a little bit alert here and say, hey, we got a game to win.
Yeah, because the bus was real quiet driving in, so he got them all lapped and going, and we got the ball game and started playing.
Lou Burdette said that what he misses about the game today as a pitcher is that one-on-one confrontation between the pitcher and the batter. He said he still relishes that. You think that's in the mind of every pitcher?
Not every pitcher, but majority. I mean, you know, there's always a few in there that are not thinking that too much, but I loved it. I mean, I loved the competition. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it helped me over my business life, too, but I love the competition of having a hitter up there and challenging him and doing things like that. I never really had any fear of any one hitter, you know. But, you know, you just had a little caution, but it was a challenge. Like Lou said, and it's true. That's a great statement.
Yeah, it's that challenge there. Mm-hmm. And if you don't find that challenge, then maybe you better pack up your bags.
That's right. Well, it's like me. Later on in my career, when I got traded to Los Angeles Angels, and Angels released me in the middle of the year because the year before they ended up in third place, and this year they were trying to make a run for it, and they released me in August because they weren't going anywhere, and then Boston Red Sox picked me up. Season was over in Boston, then I quit. I made a decision. I should not have quit because I could still throw good, but I hadn't been pitching enough to really, because you get older, you have to pitch more, not less, to stay in major league condition. And the season was over, then the Red Sox came to me wanting me to become a pitching coach. So I looked.